Welcome to This Is My Son. I'm your host, Kathy Fisher, and with me today I have a great personality from online. He is a verified Twitter user. He has seen, I've been told, over 15 movies. Yes, that's right, it's Max Eddy. How are you doing today, Max?
I'm quite well. My personality is so happy to be here today. I hope you don't mind, but I left my body in the car, so it'll just be this.
It's good. It keeps it a lot cleaner mm-hmm. here in the studio. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I've heard bad stuff about your body.
It's real gross right now.
This is the inaugural episode, and I think probably, unless there's been some kind of communication that I wasn't aware of, you the listener, don't know what's going on. So, I'm going to lay it out. The name of the podcast is This Is My Son. And the game of the podcast is I or my guest presents a piece of media that we consider to be our son. And we love it and we treasure it and we protect it. Even though we know it might be bad. It does bad things. So the first son is proposed. The guest or host, whoever's receiving, responds with one of their sons. So we exchange sons. We experience, watch, investigate, read, whatever, each other's sons. And then we come back and we just discuss our boys. So today, Max, would you like to talk about the son structure for this episode?
Yeah, I think that this is probably the most unique episode you'll ever have because you gave me your son about 10 years ago, and I put that son in a box and ignored it for a decade. And then when you, at first politely and then impolitely, requested that I watch your son, I only became more assholish in my responses. And I am talking, of course, about your son, the Godfather, your little boy, the Godfather, which I watched this morning. And paid $4 to watch it because I didn't want to have to get up off the couch to find the DVD that you gave me.
Wow, you know, it's just sort of the cherry on top of this entire situation that I gave it to you.
Cherry on this.
You're really just taking a dump on my hopes and dreams.
I mean, you know, Kathy, you used to work for me, so I feel like that's just par for the course.
Does it count as working for you when I was not paid?
when you weren't paid, and I sort of was. But yeah, so this morning I got up and I watched a three-hour movie. I think let's just start there if we may, because I asked you over the most private of means why this movie was 3 hours long, to which you responded with the 70s, which I thought was
I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
It was, actually, and the longer I watched it, I was like, yeah, oh boy, yeah. Yeah. So,
you know, people had longer attention spans back then. They had less to do.
Yeah, they really must have, especially for all that shit in Italy. should I try to, like, recap the movie from memory?
I think, first of all,
most other people have probably seen The Godfather.
yeah, I don't know that it's entirely necessary. Fair. I think, first of all, I'll describe, it's my son. So I think I'd like to speak a few moments about my boy.
Mm-hmm.
So I first watched The Godfather when I was probably a junior in high school or sometime like before my junior year, maybe. And really, 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 I don't know why exactly, but I really liked it. And watched it like several times. The first time you did mention the Italy portion, which, you know, we'll get into that later. But the first time I watched it, this is with my father. And he just opted to fast forward through that whole section as being not relevant to the plot or, you know, too boring. I don't know. Anyway, so it was edited out for me.
There's tits in it. That's part of it.
There, I think that actually was probably played in because I think it made my father of teenage girls uncomfortable.
As I said on the most private of communication systems earlier today, and I mean Twitter, if you had told me that there were boobies in this movie, I may have watched it earlier.
You know what? I don't know. considering how brief the booby scene is, I didn't consider it to be that critical of an attribute.
It may have been brief to you, but it wasn't brief to me when I slowed down playback 800%.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I hadn't taken that into account. I don't know as much about your viewing habits.
Yeah, I mean, well, just that one scene. So that one scene, that took me 3 hours to finish. So my total viewing time was 6 hours, 8 minutes.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think I rewatched it. I also then proceeded to watch Godfather Part 2. Godfather Part 3, which, you know, is an ill-advised choice. And a variety of other Al Pacino movies from the 70s and, you know, Golden Age Hollywood. And it eventually led to my, you know, short-lived and ultimately ill-fated stint as a film major and an aspiring film careerist. Is that a word?
Can I ask you a question about that? Not about the word, but, like, do you really attribute The Godfather specifically for interesting you in film to the point where you got a degree in it?
I mean, I don't think any one movie you mm-hmm. could, like, point to it and be like, yeah, it was because of that. I think it definitely came into play. It was something that I was interested in before, but I guess before that, I don't know that I had watched movies for a more, I don't know, the movies that I would not have, otherwise I would never probably have, like, been like, hey, movies of the early to mid 70s, I'm going to check them out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that hadn't really been something that I would have done previous to that. So I think it played a role. I don't know if it was the thing.
I mean, do you feel like you, now that you have that, and also you can, off the record, you can have me stop, like, trying to interview you right now, but I'm really curious because when I was watching this movie, I got the feeling that, yeah, like, I'm watching something that's, it's like, extremely well-made, well-written, and well-directed. And I, you know, I think anyone can appreciate that anyone who would appreciate a good movie could appreciate that. But I was wondering, now that you've talked about your film background, like, do you have two separate experiences with your son now that you are older and wiser? Do you have, like, the experience of just watching a really beautiful movie and you just enjoy it on that level, or do you have this other experience that's all about, like, the filmic perfection of it as a, you know, learned individual?
I think it's as with a lot of stuff where you've seen it a lot of times in both a, you know, casual watching and academic context,
mm-hmm.
is it actually loses a lot of its enjoyability. I mean, because, you know, I can point to shots and be like, oh, this is famous. You know, the cinematography, for example, in this movie is known for, like, being sort of unprecedented in the, like, usage of, like, these really, really deep blacks and this sort of, like, mahogany tones of, you know, the lighting is basically so dim that only, like, certain elements on the screen are even visible. So yeah. It has from the film major perspective, yeah, like, I can still look at it and appreciate that. I rewatched it now a couple weeks ago when we first sort of proposed this, and as a movie, I don't enjoy it as much as I used to, because I think it definitely is well-made, but not perfect. As you know, we could get into, for example, like the back end of it, it gets pretty clunky.
Yeah. I was actually wondering, like, what's like your least favorite, I don't want to say least favorite part, but, like, what's the least, your least favorite aspect of this movie?
I think it's that. I think it sort of loses momentum. Because sort of the structure of the first, you know, I would say even up to two-thirds of it, I think it's really strong, right? You set up the family, you introduce a conflict, you have a major event, there's some, like, scenes of, like, high tension, rising action, sort of a climax. So I would say the climax is when, you know, Michael shoots the police captain in Sollozzo. And then it kind of is like, yeah, well, and then he went and he just laid low for a while. And some stuff happened with Sonny. I could get into this also, is that it starts to show that it was based on a not very good book.
Yeah, they really try to get all the narrative in there when at first it seems like this really tight, taut story. And then I would agree with that.
Yeah, and I mean, the ultimate goal, right, is it's supposed to be the story of how Michael, you know, goes from being the nice, good kid who doesn't want to get involved in the family business to, like, yeah, he's totally fully embracing, taking over his father's criminal enterprise. But that arc sort of peters out for a while, and then it comes back. He's like, yeah, and now he's fine with it. He came back from Italy hardened, and now he's cool with being the godfather.
Yeah, so you told me, you gave me permission, generously, I might add, to fast forward through the Italy portion of the film. I did not return that favor. You had to watch every fucking frame of my son. but I actually liked the Italy segment. I just wish it had been handled better. I mean, it's weird because that movie, The Godfather, feels like it's not following the traditional structure of a film at all. And, you know, it's pretty bold of it to do that. And I liked the Italy bit because for once I felt like a film that was going to have to use a wrestling phrase, like a heel turn, that they were really going to invest in it. Like, you spend a lot of time seeing what Michael's doing, seeing this woman that he's in love with, seeing a little bit of their marriage. And then they kill his wife. And I appreciated for once in a movie that all of that was, you know, introduced and really invested in. But the funny thing was, I didn't actually feel like it did enough to justify how hardened Mikey is when he gets back. Like, when he comes back, there's apparently a year lapse before he goes and sees his old flame, Kay. And by that point, he's like, yeah, fuck it. Like, I'll lie to my wife. I'll have people killed. I'll have like 20 people killed in a day. And I felt like the attempt was there, probably like the most concerted attempt to show a character arc of this span. But it still wasn't enough in the end. Like, by the end, Al Pacino is just like completely evil. And I didn't quite buy it. It just didn't feel enough. And I don't know what, it almost made me think, like, what kind of investment could you make to make that convincing? Would it have to be like, should this have been like three separate movies or like a 7 or 8 episode miniseries? I think I would believe that more. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the major struggles of lots of movies that are based on books, is, you know, how do you fit a whole lot of character development? And granted, it's been a while since I read the book, which I did read.
Wow.
And the book has a lot of problems. I'll totally own to that. But, it, you know, like any novel, it has more space to do stuff. I mean, and I think they do put some, like, you do see, and I think Al Pacino, you know, to his credit, does a really good job of, you know, even at when, you know, immediately after The Godfather's shot, you know, Marlon Brando's shot early on in the movie, where, you know, he kind of swoops in and, you know, among his sort of more inept brothers takes control, and you can sort of see his innate abilities there. So I think that there is something, but yeah, it does always feel a little bit abrupt.
It's the moral turn, I think, is like, because his ability to fill a leadership role, like, I totally believed that. But I had such a hard time getting my head around going from volunteering to kill someone because you want to take revenge on the people that not only tried to kill your father once, but like repeatedly tried to kill him. And like the sense that there are rules being broken within this collection of criminals in that process.
But it's not revenge. That's the whole point, is it's business. He does it because it makes business sense for them to hit, you know, Salazzo and McCluskey.
Only at the end, well, I mean, I actually got a good sense of right through that whole scene, right until he gets to Italy, of Pacino, Mikey being really, really conflicted, even about that, not just like the morality of killing someone, but like his own motivations. But as soon as he's in Italy, he's already hardened to a great extent. And like, if they're gonna play it so that like his innocence is gone because of this murder and because of the attempts made on his father, like, I think we needed to see him withdraw more. I just felt like there wasn't, when he's in Italy, there's not enough people around him to make it clear that he's changing emotionally.
Yeah, I guess you don't really see the response, the character, you know, development response immediately after he does that. It's kind of just like, you know, cut to a few months later, stuff has gone down. Which, you know, it's, as you commented, it's a long movie already. There's just not enough room for everything, right? So
this was, this is Coppola, right?
Yes, this is Coppola.
Did he also do Taxi Driver?
No, that's Scorsese.
Okay, because I was watching this and thinking about Taxi Driver and about how, like, Taxi Driver is such a tight film that, you know, it's like a, I think it's like the quintessential or first character study, right?
I wouldn't say it's the first character study, but it's really focused character study. And you would say Taxi Driver relatively has almost no plot or very little plot. Compared to how plotty The Godfather is and how epic. It's much more sweeping, you know, it's a family anthology sort of drama.
Yeah, and I think it actually did a really good job of that. Like, there's a lot of stuff that really, like, it's beautifully made. And I didn't really think about the color until you mentioned it, but when I was watching this, I watched, like, the, I think this might even be a lengthened version, and it's definitely a restored version. And it looks spectacular. Part of that's the restoration, but, like, I was watching this, and I thought, this looks like a movie that could have been, like, released recently instead of, like, 1972 or something.
Yeah, it's shot in a very modern way.
Yeah,
and a way that we that cinematographers have since copied, basically.
Yeah, and that really holds up. It was a little bit weird, though. To one thing, I think that as a period piece, I think it sort of failed at was I don't think it really did a good job of, like, transitioning between time. Like, I sort of lost track of time because in the beginning everything is, like, really very, very 1940s, and then when they go out to Vegas, and then when they come back after that towards the end of the film, like, I'm not clear what year it is, and the mafia guys are all dressing like they did at the beginning of the movie, and they almost look comically out of place. Like, and maybe that's intentional, I don't know, but, you know, there might be a subtext there, but once they started bringing all the Vegas stuff into it, I actually, like, kind of lost track of the plot. I'm like, why are they going to Vegas? Like, what if they're going to kill everyone in New York, apparently, like, what's the benefit of, like, going to Vegas? I mean,
so long-term, this is for you to learn when you go on to watch Godfather Part 2.
I was going to say, like, I have eaten your son. Your son is now a part of me.
You ate my boy?
I mentally and spiritually ate your son, Francis Ford Coppola's... Oh, God, who's the guy that wrote the book? I should know this.
It's
the guy
Mario Puzo.
Francis Ford Coppola's Mario Puzo's The Godfather. it is now a part of me. Should I... And I wanted to watch the second one afterward, and...
You should. It's actually very good. It's a very good movie.
Yeah.
It'll take a while, but it's good.
I knew that the third one was supposed to be really bad.
Yeah, don't bother with the third one. Watch the second one.
I mean, my first clue that it might be bad was that it was made 16 years after the second one. And even, I don't know, do you spend a lot of time looking at the descriptions of things on iTunes?
Not on iTunes.
You should.
Other places.
You should. You should read those because it's an interesting exercise in rhetoric because they are all breathlessly, excitedly positive. Like, even about the worst things. For a while, and this is actually new, because for a while, if you read, like, album reviews on iTunes, someone would be like, this is thus and such's least regarded album, but, you know, like, here's one or two things about it that are actually, like, worthwhile. They would provide, like, a little bit of context and maybe a little bit of criticism, especially if it was, you know, like, there's a Elvis Costello recording, which is notorious for being his worst album. And in fact, in the liner notes, it says, this is my worst album. And, like, now when you look at iTunes, it's all just so relentlessly positive. And even that one could not make The Godfather Part 3 sound good.
Yeah, I mean, I think I watched it once, and I have almost no memory of it other than that it was bad and uninteresting, and I didn't care about any of the characters.
Yeah, and it...
You're expected to really love Sofia Coppola as an actor in it. That's the main problem.
I have such strong opinions about Sofia Coppola. And I don't really like her as an actor, and I really don't like her as a director.
Well, you will not enjoy The Godfather Part 3.
I was interested in one aspect of the Godfather, which I thought was interesting. That was a clumsy. Okay, let me redo that. One aspect of Godfather.
I'm not editing this, by the way.
Fuck. Okay. Godfather Part 1. Francis Ford Coppola's Mario Puzo's The Godfather Part 1. I thought it was interesting the way that they do mark, the way they mark climax in the film. The climax of all the moments in this film is extreme violence. The first one when Vito is killed, or an attempt on his life is made. The second one when Mikey kills Sollozzo. And then of course at the end where they fucking just murder everyone. And
when Sonny is killed.
Yeah, you know, that one actually sort of slips by, even though it is, that's a great
scene. That's the most brutal one.
Yeah, that's a great scene. I forgot about that one.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do think that's interesting that instead of, it uses, like, shocking violence sometimes out of nowhere as a really interesting way to mark, like, emotional highs. I guess everyone does that now, but I did think it was like, these are like the chapter bookmarks for the movie as I remember it. Like, those are the things that stuck out to me the most, more than anything. Yeah. That scene at the, in when Mikey and Vito are in the hospital together, though, that was great. Like, that.
Yeah, that's so high stress. It's such a great, well shot, well paced sequence.
And actually, I think they went handheld with the camera a little bit during that. Like, there's a couple of moments where, I don't know if, I think Steadicam's like a late 70s invention, right?
Yeah, I think this is pre-Steadicam.
Yeah, there's some moments where like that camera is off its tripod or something and it's like moving around in those scenes and it was so good. It was so good.
It's really good.
Marlon Brando is even managing to act like as a semi-conscious, semi-corpse, like.
And you get the famous quote, actually this made just in my family, where we often go, "I'm Enzo the Baker," to each other.
Wow, so, okay, we've been recording for 27 minutes, and you've already done a racist stereotype impression.
That's the way he says it in the movie.
And I'm sure you have plenty of Italian friends, Kathy.
I know so many Italians.
that hospital scene is great, though, because it brings Enzo back, who you have heard of but haven't seen. It brings all of the lighting and the tense moments of this movie. I was also thinking a little bit about like the role of women in this film, because the end of the movie is really clear that like Mikey is in this world now that's just men. It is this masculine secret world that literally his wife is closed off from, and that he has no compunction lying to her about. And like, women are really critical to the plot of this film, but like in a weird, distant way. Like even Apollina.
Apollonia.
She like barely speaks, like in English or Italian, like barely says anything, which is another reason why I kind of had a hard time caring about whether or not she was killed. At least they took the time to show her for like 45 minutes before they fridged her. Like,
and she had, there was some like character development done. She liked driving. We know that.
She was kind of annoying.
Kind of annoying. Was trying to learn English.
Monday, Tuesday. There's mine. I just did it now.
Yeah.
Now
see.
Now it's 100%
racist.
It's
even.
Yeah. But yeah, and like the sister who's like,
yeah, Connie.
Connie, who it turns out like her husband was beating her like for the sole purpose of getting Sonny angry. Like, that, I have to admit, I thought that was a bit of like a stretch. Like, I had a hard time buying that at all. Like, that just seemed like such a ridiculous plan, frankly.
I don't think he was beating her solely for that. I think he just also happened to be like, well, they know that I beat my wife.
Okay.
So I can leverage this into getting, you know, influence.
Getting Sonny murdered.
Getting paid or whatever.
Yeah, I had a hard time following that bit. Like, how much of I should believe what anyone's saying. So,
well, you missed the entire subplot in the book about how Sonny has a huge dick.
No, they talk about that because his wife is at the table.
Yeah, well, it's referenced. But also that the woman that he's sleeping with has an abnormally large vagina, and there's a whole subplot where she's trying to get a vagina tightening procedure.
Wow, this book sounds terrible.
Yeah, they cut that out of the movie.
It's in the Redux version. There's like these beautifully shot, wonderfully framed bits where she's like, well, how's this going to work with the wires, Doc? Mm. But yeah.
Anyways, like, yeah, women, yes, women are used like to, as a motivation, but they're mm-hmm. sort of just like passive emotional objects that are kind of outside of the action. They don't have a lot of agency. They just motivate the men.
Well, I was wondering about Kay, because it seemed like Kay is outside of that dichotomy, at least initially. Mm. And like, I almost wonder if there's like there's a Mafia Wives version of this movie that should be made, that it's like the willful progressive woman who's in love with this man who like becomes more and more involved in a criminal activity, and in the end becomes exactly what she wasn't in the beginning. I don't know.
Max, I've got big news for you. Yeah. Watch The Godfather Part 2.
Okay.
I think the thing is, you know, with Kay, you're kind of like, especially when Michael comes back, like, you're sort of rooting for, like, no, don't, you know, yeah. do not agree to get back together with him. But then, you know, obviously the tragedy is that she still is in love with him. Mm-hmm. So, even though clearly he apparently has lost the ability to love.
Or kind of act by the end. Like, he's so stiff by the end of that movie because he's just like, apparently filled with evil. It inflates you and makes you rigid and difficult. Also, I didn't know that was Al Pacino. Estelle, my space wife, had to tell me that was Al Pacino.
Oh, Max.
When I was tweeting, like, God, this guy looks like Adam Sandler. Jesus Christ.
He really does not look like Adam Sandler.
Yeah, he does.
No, he doesn't.
Totally does.
He looks like Al Pacino.
Can I tell you who my favorite character was? Or let me tell you, I don't know about my favorite character, but the character I found most attractive in this movie.
Who?
It's the Italian bodyguard who betrays him.
He's cute.
Fenenzio or something. It starts with an F. He's great. All these like shots of him and his buddy just like walking, like shirts unbuttoned, carrying shotguns around like beautiful vistas, and then they show up at the wedding like wearing the same outfit but with like a jacket over that, and it's. Oh, it was so, like, just comically wonderful. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, they were great. Being in the Italian, the actual Sicilian mob is the much more laid back.
Mm-hmm. I think, though, my favorite character was probably Tom Hagen, the adopted consigliere.
So you're saying you like whites, not Italians.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so that was weird. So that was the thing. It's like, it was interesting that there's this character who's supposed to be an outsider, but he's an outsider and an insider in the same way. At the same time, and I was like, so how is this supposed to work with Mikey's character? And I guess there is like a transition, like Hagen goes out while Mikey comes in, but usually like the role of the outsider, right, is to comment on the film or on the narrative on behalf of the viewer, right? Like we see it through their eyes as they explore something, but Hagen's not that way, and it's real. I guess it's really like Mikey, or really Kay.
Kay, yeah, in a lot of ways.
But then Kay's sidelined pretty quickly.
Yeah, but at least I think the introduction to the world, you know, when at the beginning when they come for the wedding.
Which I thought was really deft, actually. Like, they really do a good job of, like, laying out, like, all the important relationships in the movie are laid out in that first, like, admittedly very long, but, like, you know, as exposition goes, that's, like, the best I've seen in movies.
Yeah, it's great. And they have, like, a couple, like, people just telling each other anecdotes about stuff, and then that defines... That's, like, enough to establish, like, whole dynamics.
Mm-hmm. And then there's that, like, whole bit where, like, old people sing in Italian. This is really... But, yeah, I liked Hagen a lot. I think his arc would have been another one that would... Like, I guess maybe with the passage of time have come to expect films to be more character-driven, but I know that this is not that kind of movie.
Well, I don't know. I think it, you know, it's a family anthology, so to a certain extent, it's a collection of character-driven arcs.
Yeah.
But you can't really drill into specific characters as much.
And it's funny to me, too, because I've only seen The Godfather. Well, oh, maybe I should talk about my relationship to The Godfather quickly. Can I do that?
Sure.
Okay. So I have tried to watch this movie several times because I went through a mob movie phase when I was, like, 9. So I saw, like... The Sting, which is great, and The Untouchables, which is extremely approachable and rips off, you know, great Soviet cinema.
And also has a certain person in it who will be in your son, which we'll discuss soon.
Oh my god, yeah, that would have been the best segue. Oh, we should have set this up better.
God damn it.
So yeah, I tried to watch The Godfather because that was like the movie, and it was like, it was too boring for me as a child. And then like every few years I would either seek out or like be presented with an opportunity to watch The Godfather, and I would either fall asleep or get bored or something would come up because it's like, it's 3 hours long. I think one of the last times I tried to watch before now, I was at this like dorm room party my freshman year, and it was kind of like, hey, is this like gonna turn into like a sexy thing? Like, I'm not sure what the dynamic is with all these people. And then
somebody whips out The Godfather.
it was like, let's watch The Godfather. I'm like, okay,
what? That's not gonna be sexy.
And then while I was watching this, I realized that not only had I not seen the parts in Italy, but all of the stuff leading up to Mikey actually killing the guy, because I think maybe like there's a TV edit or something floating around out there where Vito is the shot. And then it goes immediately into Mikey volunteering to kill Sollozzo.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I just remembered it weird. Maybe that was the only time like I tuned back in or something. But yeah, that was kind of weird and off-putting. And I missed like, you know, some of the best parts of the movie. The other weird thing for me is that I've only seen this movie once, but I've seen the parody of it, Mafia, about 3 or 4 times.
Why, Max? Why?
I don't know. I don't know, Kathy. It's really bad. It's really bad. But yeah.
So, consensus. What do you feel about my boy?
Can I say one other thing first?
You may.
Thank you. I know from experience that a lot of like bro-y douchey guys really like this movie. Mm. And I can totally see why, because it does present this like these like gentlemen criminals, and also like really intense violence and sex and vice and great acting, great filmmaking, and also like a world without women where dudes just hang out and do dude stuff and experience dude emotions. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, that definitely has been a turnoff for me for years about seeing this flick. Because most, besides you and like a handful of other people, the only introduction I've had to this movie is like, it's a great film, or guys with like popped collars, hats on backwards, like having Godfather parties like in college. I don't know. It seems weird to me that it has that crossover appeal.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't like that it's associated with the demographic of people who have, you know, Scarface posters in their dorm rooms.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I also haven't seen that, son.
I haven't either. Yeah. I
really?
Really bothered. Oh, not we should do that. Particularly interested in it either.
No.
But,
So you want final consensus. I think that this is rightly one of the greatest films of film history. I think it's beautiful. Like a lot of great films by this particular class of director, I think it's got some like weird story decisions, but in the end, I feel like those are risks that maybe didn't pay off, but I appreciate that they were made. I don't think this movie would be as compelling if it was like a standard 3-act, 90-minute movie. And I don't say that lightly, because I really do believe that 90 minutes is the perfect length for any film. 90 mm-hmm. minutes to 2 hours. You know, Mad Max is amazing, and it's exactly 2 hours long. You know, I think this is an incredible experiment. I'm actually really looking forward to watching the second one if it's just more of the same. I do think it kind of falls on character a little bit. I think it probably would have been more compelling, but yeah.
Well, it's good to hear. It's definitely good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as we discussed earlier, this has been a long time coming that Max watches the thing that I recommended to him so many years ago. Welcome back to the podcast. We've been on a little break. Now we are going to discuss Max Eddy's son. Max, would you like to introduce your son for us?
This is my boy, and his name is The Hunt for Red October. I love this movie. I watch it every year. I like to tell people that every year when I watch this movie, I do it while drinking a series of Budweisers and eating a Big Mac, because it's the most American possible experience. That's not always true. Sometimes I just watch this movie. I really like it because it's got fun Cold War stuff. It's got a really surprisingly good cast. Submarine movies are really great for me. I really like submarine movies for some reason. And this is also, like, I've seen a few other Tom Clancy novel adaptations, and this is by far the best one that I've seen. And I think this also sort of beats out a lot of other non-James Bond, like, Cold War thriller-type movies. So, yeah, it pushes a lot of good buttons for me.
Okay, well, yeah, I have also, I've probably not seen it as many times as you, but have also seen Your Son many times, because I that's just the type of family I come from.
Mm-hmm. A Russian one.
I would say more it's just a pro-Sean Connery one.
Does that mean that you have developed a Sean Connery impression based on this film?
No. Well, mostly just my constant criticism is you can tell, even if you have almost no understanding of Russian, that his Russian accent is really bad.
It's so bad. Oh, my God. Sean Connery is like the world, like the parts he gets cast in. My other son, which I hope that we will do another show about, The Name of the Rose, where he plays a German monk. Like he's actually doing a much better job acting in that movie, but he's still just Sean Connery. Like, his voice and his mannerisms are, like, so ingrained that he can't.
He's not a character actor.
No.
he's a Sean Connery actor.
Yeah, and I actually do have a Sean Connery impression from this movie, if you would like to hear it.
Go for it.
You know, Ryan, some things in here don't react too well to bullets.
It's good. It's pretty good.
It's like one of the least memorable lines in the film, but it always struck me as just like, why is this guy who we've established that can apparently speak perfect idiomatic English suddenly like waxing poetic about like, don't hit the nuclear weapons?
Well, he's just being snarky. I think that's the whole point of that line.
He's just been shot.
Just being a dick.
He's just been shot.
Yeah, but so he's also the hardened Russian submarine captain, so.
He's Lithuanian by birth, as you'll recall.
Oh, yeah, of course.
He's got no ties to
Lithuania. Oh, that was very clear from his accent that it was definitely a Lithuanian-Russian inflection.
Yeah, yeah.
So. I actually did write down one quote.
What was it? What was it?
I took notes. We will listen to their rock and roll.
Oh, God, I love that. I love that speech so much. That might be his best acting in the movie.
Yeah. So I enjoy The Hunt for Red October. I, you know, as what it is, which is, you know, was it from the early 90s or late 80s when this was made?
I think it's the early 90s. This is the part where I'm going to, like, actually just look shit up on Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's fine. I think it was the early 90s, too. So, as an early 90s war thriller, it's pretty much one of the best ones. It's up there mm-hmm. with the greats. That said...
This is a 1984 novel, and it came out in 1990.
1990, exactly. All right. Anyways, I mean, if we want to talk about, I think going back to our Godfather discussion, stories that where women have no role,
yep.
and no agency. I love that, you know, they show Jack Ryan's wife at the beginning, I think Beverly Crusher, basically.
Yeah, like Gates McFadden.
She's just like swoops in, she's like, hey, sup, I'm out. And then she's gone, there's no other women for the entire movie, not even on the aircraft carrier, just like in the background.
Her 7-year-old daughter appears more frequently than she does in this film.
When does the daughter appear?
She's in more scenes. She is actually in more scenes. She has that whole bit in the very beginning, right before Gates McFadden shows up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Not much more, but...
Anyways, the point is that the bulk of the movie is a total, you know, sausage zone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, and it totally, like, it's a big penis fest taking place in a bunch of penises beneath the water.
A bunch of underwater penises.
And they're shooting penises at each other, too.
Silent penises.
That might actually be the working title for this film.
Silent dongs.
Yeah, I you know what?
Dong is the sound that radar makes.
I respond with one dong. One dong only, please.
Yeah.
I think the only other time that women are even mentioned in this is that, like, sometimes Jack Ryan talks about his daughter and that other American, more forgettable submarine captain who sort of looks like Roy Scheider, who should have been in this movie, mentions that his Morse is so bad that he might be sending dimensions on Playmate of the Month.
Oh, yeah. So there's a woman. It's basically, this is a feminist movie.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? I hadn't even considered, I am ashamed to say that I had not even considered, like, the total lack of women in this movie. Probably because this is, like, so ingrained in the genre of this kind of film. Like, I don't think that would happen if they made it now. But, like, in terms of 90s action flicks, it's like, yeah.
It's like, well, we've got a demographic we're shooting for.
Oh, we're going to hit it.
And there we go.
Yeah, actually, the thing that I find, when I thought of, like, reasons why I don't like this movie, and why this is, like, a movie I go to bat for, much like Steely Dan, which also has no actual women involved, is that it is so horrifically jingoistic. America is just the best place. America makes no mistakes. Well, the American government makes mistakes, but the concept of America is so important that, like, these guys have to, like, leave Russia and come with their big fucking submarine. And, like, the only people who even are, like, moderately sympathetic to Soviet life is the political officer who's killed very early on. They make it clear that he's an asshole. Mm. And Tim Curry's character, who is just, like, this lovable doof. Like, he just loves the ballet, and none of the cool defectors will be his friend. Like, I love that that's a thing that keeps happening in this movie. But yeah, like, it's sort of like, it fits that bill of just, like, you know, flag waving, boner pumping action flicks that I just find generally so distasteful.
Yeah, I mean, there's a definitely an American exceptionalism thing here. But on the other hand, another thing that I sort of noted was that basically all of the main characters are people who are, like, ultra competent at their jobs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, and that includes, though, the, you know, Sean Connery and Sam Neill's characters. And even, you know, like, Stellan Skarsgård's other Russian submarine captain guy. Like, they're all people who they know what they're doing.
Yeah,
they're good at their jobs.
Konovalov, I really like that guy. Oh, not Konovalov, that's not who that is.
It's good that you know the names of all of the obscure Russian characters. I've
seen this movie a lot. Yeah, and that really plays into the typically Clancy-esque. It's less like American exceptionalism, more like military exceptionalism. Mm. Like, men in the military are the best at what they do, and in some ways that, like, surpasses their political allegiances. Like, I think it's important that the political officer... I've read a little bit of this book. It's really boring. I was not able to get into it. But they make it really clear that the role of the political officer is basically to be, like, a living propaganda machine because the submarine is going to be cut off from, like, contact for months or, you know, like, a year at a time, right?
Yeah.
So he's not, like... He's not one of them. He's not, like, a trained and competent naval officer. He's not even, like, a little cook, like the spy, who is also incredibly competent because he runs circles around, like, the best submarine captain in the Russian fleet. Mm-hmm. You're very right to point that out.
Yeah, I think it's a... Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's not more to say about that because it's really there's not much to dig into. I think other than, like, here are the people that you're meant to like.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it cool that they're in these tense situations?
I think the movie tries to play with the idea that it's ambiguous whether or not they're going to defect until.
Yeah, for a while, but then, like, once Jack Ryan figures it out, we're like, oh yeah.
Yeah, because it's like...
We trust him.
What would
the
point
smart.
Of the movie be otherwise? Yeah, and it's kind of disappointing that they weren't able to balance that. Like, that would have made it a real movie, not like a summer blockbuster type.
Like, yeah, like, is it actually ambiguous whether or not he really wants to defect?
Yeah, because that would be fun. Like, that would be really, really fun.
Let's remake it.
Yeah, I would absolutely do that. I do like that this movie, like, The Godfather, does introduce all of the concepts for the film within the first, like, 20 minutes.
Hmm.
They've got James Earl Jones, they've got the rescue sub, they've got and, like, the October itself, the Red October itself, and explaining, like, how it works and why it's important. Like, all of that is just,
just good exposition.
Yeah, and it's done in a pretty natural way.
Yeah, and they set up all the players, they establish the problem,
mm-hmm.
they establish, you know, the situation, like, got the quote unquote caterpillar drive. Whether or not that's a possible thing.
We talked a little bit about this, right? Like,
yeah.
I'm fairly certain I have read like whole Wikipedia articles about whether or not like a magneto hydrodynamic hydroelectric drive could actually work. I don't remember, but every time they say it's like a jet engine for the water, all I can think of is like a fucking Ski-Doo. It's basically the same thing.
You just see the submarine where it's, you know, the front end is like sticking out and there's a huge wake coming out behind it.
It's like, it's so fast.
A huge tail of the water in the air.
Can't catch it. It's so quick and maneuverable.
It's doing like sharp turns.
It's doing donuts out in the middle of the Atlantic.
Doing jumps off ramps.
Woo!
Huge submarine.
I would really, I would find that cartoonishly hysterical if it was like a fucking Akula class submarine going just like off sick ramps.
Doing jumps.
Wakeboarding.
Yeah, got guys wakeboarding behind it.
So since there isn't much to dig into here, maybe what we should talk about then is, I think, the genre of submarine films, because I do love a good submarine movie. And I think they're very similar to space thrillers, but I think they're as close as we're going to get to, like, before The Martian came out, something like a hard science fiction space film where it's like the environment itself is dangerous. Like, there's an inherent understanding, I think, to the viewer that you're on a submarine. This is unnatural to a certain extent.
It's a bunch of people who are stuck in this vessel in these reaches of the world or the universe where humans are not meant to live, and that there'll be instant death if they go outside or if there's a breach anywhere. So yeah, everyone has to be extremely competent or else something can go disastrously wrong, basically. So yeah, I would say it is definitely similar to space.
And I think this is like one of the better examples of it, because it's not a disaster movie like Gray Lady Down, which is another okay submarine movie. And there's nothing supernatural like there is in The Abyss, which is my other favorite submarine movie. But this one, like, I think it handles like the, and it also it handles like some of like the interesting aspects of like submarine warfare, about how they're sneaking around each other and like hiding in each other's wake. And you know, like, there's this that tense moment where the Red October turns around and they're worried that it's going to detect the USS Dallas directly behind it. And there's that moment, it's like, oh my god, like, we could slam into this other boat that doesn't see us. Yeah, it's good shit.
So how do you feel about Das Boot?
I have not seen Das Boot.
What?
Yeah.
Max.
Is that your boy?
It's not my boy.
Episode 2, I watched Das Boot and you watched The Name of the Road.
Oh no. But I mean, Das Boot is like the ultimate real suspense. I mean, like, it has, you know, it's set in World War II, so the technology is not as advanced. So there's a lot more, like, we had to go down to a super deep depth, and there's a very good chance that our submarine will collapse and crush us all.
Yeah.
And it's very German.
I do, is it like a German expressionist play in the submarine?
No. I mean, just a lot of sweaty German men in a submarine while rivets creak and pop out of the walls.
And then the Italian bodyguard shows up there, like leaning against the motor, picking his teeth and stroking his shotgun.
Yeah,
the ultimate crossover. Yeah.
I wouldn't fit with Das Boot.
But did you find like the submarine warfare aspects of this thrilling at all, or does that not?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're definitely interesting. I mean, I think that those to me are probably some of the best things. I mean, I like the suspense, obviously. Those, it's good that when it's built up.
Yeah.
You know, with submarine stuff, it's, you know, stuff sort of happens in slow motion.
Yeah.
But there could be disaster at any moment. So like when they're navigating the trench thing.
Oh, that's so great, where they're doing dead reckoning. They're like, they've got the clock and they know how fast they're going. And
yeah.
They're like,
so those are great. Good sequences, yeah. I think. It's probably, I don't know that I have the same, you know, emotional, passionate love for it that I know that you do. I think that it's maybe a part of you being a dude who loves technical stuff and crafts. I think it's probably the same reason why you like, yeah, you know, we were talking about space movies.
Yeah.
You like spaceships and submarines.
And I also like blimps. I just like big, big dicks that you live in. It's just,
yeah, just like dick vehicles.
It's going to name my son Dick Vehicles.
Dick P vehicles.
Well, but I guess the thing about this that I like also is that because it's submarine warfare and it's a pretty like slavishly accurate with, you know, with obviously like accepting magical things like the silent drive. The fact that like one torpedo could kill them, I think they actually sell that really well in this movie. And like where most other films, like people get shot multiple times and are fine. And like, you know, the boat or whatever, like the protagonist's vehicle will get like half blown to hell, but still pull through. Like that bit where they're in the trench and trying to not get hit by that torpedo, like that, it doesn't even hit them and it still nearly sinks their ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they establish the stakes really well.
Yeah, and they keep it up. That's another thing I like, is that they do manage to, like, at any moment make it seem like the disaster could happen at any time.
But don't you think that near the end, that sort of trails off? I mean, they have a gun battle in a submarine.
Yeah. but to the credit of that gun battle, I think Sean Connery does a good job of selling his injury, that he's not able to keep going, and that Sam Neill, who's great in this movie, by the way,
mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Sam Neill is killed with like a single gut shot, and yeah, like that, those sort of displays of fallibility are great. But then Jack Ryan is like Alec Baldwin is just like sweating profusely and like swinging off of like gantries and shit, and they
he's like a CIA, he's an analyst, he's not, yeah, he was in the military or whatever,
he was a Marine trainee for a hot minute and then like left because he injured his back, so he's like yeah, I was like, really?
He's not like a commando. He's like he's a nerd.
Yeah, he's not.
The whole point.
He's not fucking James Bond. He wishes he was like that, and I guess that's where it gets a little weird, like a little bit wish fulfillment-y, right? Because
that's
the dream of every nerd, is that secretly they're all Navy SEALs that could save Sean Connery.
Yeah, totally. If they just had the opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the Tom Clancy projection, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he wishes that he could be in a submarine and go do all this cool stuff.
Well, he had some kind of Navy background, some kind of military background, but I don't know if he was like the guy that wrote all the Bond novels, that was like, yeah, he was in military intelligence, but he was like, he had a desk job.
Hmm.
Yeah,
well, there's no way we could ever find out.
Yeah, definitely not. But yeah, that those are the parts, like, that's why I'm ashamed of this movie, is that
I don't think you need to be ashamed of it.
I mean, I think I really should be, though. Like, it's got great... It's a really fun movie, but unlike other really fun movies, like Independence Day, which is just silly, and it's, like, completely over the top, this one, it has, like, all these realistic, tense elements, and then it has this just, like, overlay of jingoistic wish fulfillment over the whole thing, which I find, like, disheartening. Like, I really wanted, like, the crew to be more like waffling about their defection or something. Like, I needed something more. I needed it to be a real movie and not a summer blockbuster.
Okay, so we've figured out what Max wishes The Hunt for Red October really were.
Yeah.
Which are more serious, much more boring drama.
That I would probably never watch, never enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why you watch this every year.
Is that what Crimson Tide is? I've never seen Crimson Tide, but it looks like the poster is very similar to this one.
I don't remember. I feel like I've seen it, but I don't know. What about U-571? What about that one?
Oh, I didn't see that one either. I wanted to see
As a supposed lover of submarine movies, there's a lot of famous submarine movies you have not seen.
Yeah, but I heard U-571 is really bad.
Yeah, I don't remember. I am not a submarine movie person, but I have seen U-571 and Das Boot.
Oh, you know, no, I'm sorry. I'm not thinking of U-571. I'm thinking of K-19, The Widowmaker. I heard that one sucks.
Oh, that's the Harrison Ford shitty one.
Yeah.
I think I've seen that one too, though.
Okay, so what's the best... So you are my master, my filmic master. So first off, what's the best submarine movie? And then secondly, what of filmic value exists in The Hunt for Red October? What could put this in the same shelf as The Godfather?
Well, I still think that this is probably the most entertaining submarine movie in recent memory. I mean, Das Boot might be, it's been a while since I've seen it, but it might be filmically better, but it's unpleasant to watch because of how tense it is. And very German. How tense and German it is. I feel like the last time I saw it, I was maybe like 10.
Oh.
There's a lot of subtitle reading for me at that age.
It's like when I saw Battleship Potemkin. I was about that age.
Oh, God. No. Talk about bad submarine. Wait, is there a... There's no submarine.
No.
But that was before the invention of submarines.
No, it's about the same time, but there's a boat.
Yeah, it's more of a battleship.
There's at least two battleships.
Named Potemkin?
One of them is named Potemkin. There's another couple other battleships.
Anyways, I know there was rats, and then there was the Odessa Steps, which I saw in film school probably 17 times.
Maggots and everything.
Yeah, it's not a good movie.
It really isn't.
I objectively understand from a film major perspective why it is important, but just not fun to watch.
So now give me that perspective for The Hunt for Red October. Is its best aspect is that it's just very entertaining?
I think that's its best aspect. I think it has a lot of good aspects. As you mentioned, I think it has a really great cast. Just even watching it, you're like, wow, they sure got a lot of famous people to be in this movie.
James Earl Jones, I forgot to mention.
James Earl Jones, whatever, Fred, what's his name, who became a congressman or judge or something.
Sure.
the captain on the aircraft carrier.
Yeah,
Fred, what is his name? Fred Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, Tim Curry, you know, James Earl Jones, all that stuff. It's very entertaining. It's got a great cast. I think that it does some clever things with stuff such as, like, visually differentiating the American versus Soviet submarine by, like, the color of the light and stuff inside of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got the red Soviet submarine. For example.
And Red October, like, the inside of it looks like a fucking spaceship. It's, like, huge and spacious. And they're
and dark,
And I love that they're, everyone else's periscope looks like an actual periscope, but the Red October one is, like, mirrored. It's like this disco ball that just drops into the middle of it.
Well, it's a brand new submarine.
Sure.
I would say also there's a couple... Well, one of my favorite things every time I see it is... When the moment in the film where they decide it's not worth it to make Sean Connery speak in Russian anymore.
Yeah.
So they zoom in on his mouth, and then they zoom out, and all of a sudden they speak in English. Which is actually, when you think about it, is a very clever visual trick to be like, yeah, we're going to be translating it now. So, very consciously, here we're doing it.
That is something that I've heard people really, and like film people, like complain about with this movie, that it doesn't, because of that, it doesn't take its audience seriously.
I don't think that's true.
Yeah, and part of me is like, do you know what movie this is?
The fact that they even spoke in Russian at all is, you know, notable.
And that, like, people really, you know, they give it their best shot. Sam Neill's doing pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I actually really like that, like, as far as movies where there's, like, a language barrier, I think this one handles that really well. Not as interestingly as, like, in The Godfather, where people are switching back and forth between Italian, and sometimes for dramatic sake, and also sometimes not even being translated at all, which I thought was cool. But I if you're going to do it, I do feel like this film does it well. Like, I think it's the best version of that.
They put the effort into being like, yeah, it's, we're going to establish this. These are Russians. They're speaking Russian. They're on a Russian submarine. And then, you know, we're going to make it easier for you to understand the movie for the rest of it.
Yeah. And I also think it sort of like frees up the actors a lot more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You probably get a lot more latitude in terms of acting when you can speak in your native language.
Just especially like when fucking Sean Connery just trying his best. Trying his best.
Poor guy.
Oh.
How old is Sean Connery? 500?
When he made this, he was 500. Now he's well older than
700?
I'm actually looking up. I'm honestly surprised that Sean Connery is not dead yet.
Yeah, you'd think that, you know, all those decades of hard living.
Oh my God, he's only 85.
Only 85? That's still pretty old.
In 1989, he was proclaimed the sexiest man alive. And at the age of 69, hello, in 1999, he was voted the sexiest man of the century.
I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So, you know, he keeps going. He's obviously made of tougher stuff than some celebrities who died recently. Because they were too weak. They submitted to cancer.
Can I read you a quote from his Wikipedia article?
Sure.
Afterwards, he returned. He was discharged from the Navy because of an ulcer. Afterwards, he returned to the co-op, a dairy co-op, I think. Then worked as, among other things, a lorry driver, a lifeguard at Portobello's swimming baths, a laborer, an artist's model for the Edinburgh Court of College, College of Art, and at suggestion of Mr. Scotland, Archie Brennan, a coffin polisher.
How do you get that coffin polishing gig? Is that still a job?
That's probably the best that you could ever get, I guess.
Like, I mean, I feel like everyone should be able to work at least a couple weeks as a coffin polisher in their life. Just to, you know, think about what you think about during that time, right? You really have time to consider mortality while you're working as a coffin polisher.
I really think that that's probably what made him capable to act in The Hunt for Red October. Coffins always make me think of submarines, so.
Yeah, well, it's shaped like a dong.
Yeah. So, Kathy, final take on both these movies.
Well, start off with my boy. You know, I love The Godfather. I always will. I think I'm still always drawn in every time I watch it. It's, you know, got its issues. It's got some flaws. And I do think it does lose some momentum near the end.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you know, still, it's one of the greats. And it will always be. Probably not, does not rank, no longer ranks among my, you know, maybe the top 10 of my favorite movies, but it's very close. So that's Gov. I don't know if we're going to have a rating system other than just a lot of qualitative discussion.
How many Godfathers out of how many Godfathers do you give this?
I give this 4 out of 5 Godfathers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And The Hunt for Red October, I think, is an incredibly solid action movie. I've seen it now many times, and I think it still holds up. You know, there's some flaws. I would say representation is a big one, especially when you're looking at it with a modern lens. Although, you know, it was made in 1990. This wasn't exactly like the 50s.
Yeah, and actually what still surprises me every time is that James Earl Jones, a black man, is like, he's not the head of the CIA, but he's up there apparently. Like, that was, to me, still like a little interesting move for a 90s movie to make.
Well, again, it's the 90s.
It's the 90s,
you can't,
yeah,
be like, oh my god, they hadn't even learned about racism yet.
That
they were aware of it.
That's true, but let's be honest, it's a movie in the 90s.
I don't know, I feel like, well, here's one other thing I sort of want to go into.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like the action movies of the 80s and 90s were more progressive than a lot of recent movies, and I think some data will back me up if I were to actually cite it.
Yeah, dig into that, because like I'm going to be honest, I have not seen a lot of action films generally, and not a lot from that time period either.
Well, I think that there was sort of a trope that persisted through the time period that was kind of the, like, the super cool, also incredibly intelligent black tech nerd, mm, which is present in this movie too by the radar operator guy on the American ship. But it also reminds me of, there's a similar guy amongst the terrorist group in Die Hard.
Yeah.
But that's not something that you see that often anymore. It was kind of a really specific trope almost. But so there are at least two black guys with significant speaking parts in the plot of this movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, look at some recent action movies, might not even have that.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Anyway, so, you know, it doesn't do great with women, does okay with race, not amazing, doesn't pass the, what's the race equivalent of the Bechdel test?
Decency?
Human decency?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
One.
Yeah, it doesn't pass that test. But otherwise, I think it does okay. Can I give partial submarine dongs? What's the metric for Hunt for Red October?
Silent dongs. How many silent dongs out of how many silent dongs?
I give this 3.5 silent dongs out of 5.
I think that's very fair.
Okay. Well, what do you think?
I don't think I could actually add anything more to what you've already said, and I think we're circling the drain now, so we should probably,
let's flush it down.
Let's flush it down. Let's
flush those nuggets.
Let's scuttle this ship. Maybe here's something to close on. I've got the Sean Connery Wikipedia article up here, and I think this really sums up everything that needs to be said about, actually, I think both of these movies. So Sean Connery, He was known during his teen years as Big Tam and has claimed to have lost his virginity to an adult woman in an ATS uniform at the age of 14.
So, what are your ratings?
That's my rating for both of these films.
That's your rating is Sean Connery losing his virginity to an adult woman.
I give
that sounds positive. I get is it positive?
No, that's creepy. I give The Godfather 4 out of 5 cannolis, and I give now I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5, and I'm going to give The Hunt for Red October 4 out of 5 glass cups of samovar tea.
Okay, that sounds pretty solid.
Yeah, I'm going to rate it slightly higher because I think that it's remarkable that a film like that can hold up past its genre due date.
Sell-by date.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, Max, it's been an engaging episode.
I'm finally glad that I got to consume your boy after 10 years.
It's good. It makes me feel good that you enjoyed my boy.
I loved your boy.
I hope you want to see my boy's brother, Godfather Part 2, which is also a good boy.
Yeah, we'll come back and we'll do this again, and I'll watch The Godfather Part 2.
This is just going to be the Discuss the Godfather podcast.
It's only going to have 3 episodes.
And then you just start giving me different Sean Connery movies.
Yeah, okay. No, we could totally do
that. Oh, no. Anyways, I'm sure that we will see you back here on This Is My Son in the near future, because you're one of my few friends.
Oh, Kathy, I am humbled and grateful to be here.
Thanks to our listener.
Janine, we're glad you're out there.
I know that you sent the letter that you're going to listen, so I'm hoping that you're still going to do it. I'm really banking on that. Stamps.com is too early there, so...
You didn't think of a way out of this, did you?
Outro 1.
And you just fade out on that.
Congrats, that's now the theme song. goodbye, I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Okay, bye.